Buddhave Gaura Chandraya Radhikaya Tadalaya Krishnaya Krishna Bhaktaya Tad Bhaktaya Namo Namaha. So again, pranam to each one of you. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. Greetings from Siam Priyakunj. I'm here in the Swiss Alps for the next 10 days, and then I'm moving to another part of the Swiss Alps for another week to Anandadham. Having arrived here last afternoon after spending, since our last week and today, we have been a few days in Rome after our last gathering. From Laverna, went back to Rome for a few days, had some meetings there, meeting some new friends, Bhakti Lalita Devi and others you may know. And then traveled to Switzerland, where we had a, in Zurich, we had a small gathering in the beautiful nature some days ago, speaking about karma, free will, and the mystery of chance. And yeah, in the context of that, if you news have come to my life and to other people's life in connection to the passing of particularly Srila Tulananda Swami, who was a very dear person for me in my life, very close to me, especially the first 20 years of my devotional journey, being like a co-acharya of the first spiritual family I joined 26 years ago. And we all knew he was passing. He had pancreatic cancer, so it was known that it was just a matter of months, weeks, days, and the last few days he was almost expected that to happen. But still is, of course, is a something new always comes when you receive the official news. And it's always a mixture of celebration and joyfulness, because you know when someone lives their life with deep alignment to divine grace, with serious commitment to the path, and with honesty and openness, their future is bright, Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say. But at the same time, of course, there is grieving that needs to be embraced as a confirmation of our love and caring for those who departed in this case. So I was talking about that today with another friend, because today also another Vaishnava that didn't have the chance to meet in person, Hastarata Prabhu. He was originally initiated by Srila Prabhupada, and then he connected with Sri Haridas Shastri Maharaj in the Gadadhar Parivar. He passed today, like actually a few hours ago, so I received the news. So I had the chance of having some interaction with him, and I heard from Krishna Chandra, Hari Vyasadeva, and other friends about the special soul he was, and had a glimpse of that by our email interactions. And yeah, I was invited by him to visit him. He lives in the mountains in Slovenia. There was no chance to do this time, and there won't be chance, maybe chance to visit his place after his passing. So again, days of trying to develop some, as I was talking today to one friend, like, we need to learn how to flirt with death. No? The more the older I get, the more people that I know dies, basically. No? The more you come to know that dies. Again, we know what we refer to with death. So as we approach our own passing, the arrangement of the environment is that more and more, you become more and more aware of people around your circle that are passing. So it's a way of warming up for your own transition. And yeah, I'm cultivating a healthy flirting, if you will, with death, a holy communion with death, and radical acceptance of that chapter as a crucial part of life, right? If we live life without death in all its different forms, it's kind of living a half-baked life, basically. Like the Buddha is said to have said once, like those who live as if death does not exist. Those who live as they will never die, they die as they will have never have lived, something like that, right? So the concept, the notion of death brings some gravitas, bring some sobriety, bring some some humbling set of priorities for us to focus on what's actually important and crucial, besides the things that we consider important and crucial on a daily basis. And that's why the Bhagavatam begins with this sober context, right? Parikshit Maharaj being told you have 7 days to live, and the whole Bhagavatam unfolds from that unique context of confrontation with death, and how your priorities ideally reorder, and you can focus on what's more important. And since we don't know when we have our last 7 days, we are always invited to keep death close to us, like many Aghoris or Stoics or people from different lineages will have in their desk, like some skull or some symbol of death, to not lose sight of that reality, which is the most hidden reality, the thing that people hides the most, right? Like how in the Mahabharata, this is being asked by two Yudhishthira Maharaj, was the most amazing thing, speaking about amazingness and wonderfulness, astonishment. He's like, that death is all over, and we keep hiding it. We keep escaping from it. We keep looking into so many other directions, so we don't have to acknowledge the reality of death, and we don't start dying in the healthy day, way we need to die now, die before we die, as these mystics put it. So, as simple and as basic as the topic may sound, and we may say, no, but we're eternal, we're not this body, we are spiritual souls. Yes. But still, even if we have that clear in theory and in practice, especially if we have that clear, you will realize how much death there is to embrace from a non-biological point. Now, if you have very clear, okay, there is no actual biological death to myself, to anything, even matter continues to exist in another form. Especially when I have that clear, then I'm invited to continue my flirtation with death in a more subtle level. It's not that now I don't need to talk about death anymore. No, now we are really starting to talk about the death that needs to be embraced on a daily basis, for eternity into eternity. New death, new birth, continuous, ongoing, infinite cycle. So anyhow, this has been some of my reflections these days, and I happen to be now here for a 10-day solitary retreat in the Alps, so it fits very well for the situation to spend considerable time in reflection, in contemplation, and in prayer. So hopefully I can honor properly the time and space that has been graciously gifted to me to be here these days, and to be with you today as well. That's also part of my solitary retreat in silence. Krishna Katha is a form of mauna, a form of silence as well, a form of non-noise, of embracing proper, hopefully proper sound. So you're all welcome again. And as I said before, if you have any questions, any topics you would like to explore today, anything you may like to bring to the table, you are more than free to raise your digital hand, and eventually we will try to address that. Today I'm doing the hosting and a few other things, since though Bhakturasa is connected, her internet connection is not the best, so just in case we are doing it over here. So we'll invite the first digital hand raised, which comes from Rasangi in California, the US. So you can
Well,
unmute yourself, Rasangi. Welcome.
I'm in New Jersey now.
You're in New
I'm on the
Jersey.
East Coast,
Okay.
helping take care of my mother,
Yes.
who's in rehab because she broke her arm. Anyway, in our reading group, we're reading Human Beings versus Human Becomings, and are so charmed by the possibility there of and the permission to let go of static goals and open up to potential and becoming. So I don't know if you could talk a little bit about that. It sounds very freeing to us, to me, that the goals that we set for ourselves, that we that I have received from my conditioning, I can let go of and open up to unfolding of life instead of achieving a static goal, making that a mission, and feeling dejected when it doesn't happen or I fail at it. So I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about the becoming, huh? The wonderfulness of becoming instead of a being.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. And of course, I think all of you know, but just in case you don't know, part of my answer is that I have written a whole book about it, and this is the book Rasang is referring to. But it's always good to go back to it. Not to my book, but just to the topic, because it's by nature, it's an ongoing becoming, so you can always return to it and it's ever fresh. So, yeah, I mean, the one point that I try to make there, of course, is we don't even need to make a difference between being and becoming in the sense that real being, at least according to the perspective I try to present in the book, which I think is the perspective brought by the Gaudiya tradition and other mystical sister traditions, is that being is becoming, right? That real being is becoming. Who we are is all that we can be. Who we are is to be defined in terms of our potential. Anything and everything that exists is what it is plus potential, right? So being without becoming, in one sense, is not true being. That will be the point, right? The true being includes becoming. You know, if we just try to be without becoming, then you don't become and you don't be. You don't are. So I think it's important to, I know it sounds simple, but I think we need to pound that post and need to do it for myself to begin with, that we cannot truly separate beingness from becomingness. Those at times we can speak about being and just be and be, but again, who we are is a dynamic unit of potential, not the task, the Shakti. Speaking about ourselves, just to keep it relevant. So who we are, as Śrīla Siddhārtha Mahārāja will teach many times, who we are needs to be defined in terms of our potential, because Tathāstha Shakti means that. We expose ourselves in our freedom of choice. We expose ourselves to different energies, to different shelters, to different environments, and that facilitates the expression of potential. So we are not separate from our potentiality. We are not separate from all that we can be. And that's as simple as that sounds, is at least for me, such an important paradigm shift. Because if we lose sight of the becoming part of the equation, which is again what we are, we lose sight of what we are. And everything becomes fixed, stagnant. Even the notion of I'm here and I need to get to that particular place and that particular goal, that particular attainment is conceived and lived in very non-dynamic ways. Like I'm here and then I get there and that's it. Instead of the here is dynamic, the there is dynamic, and the path from here to there is dynamic. So, so yeah, the wonderfulness of becoming is in the becoming itself, right? It's a very humbling prospect, and that's why I get it can be hard to digest, because the other one fits more the false ego, fits more the notion of attainment. I did it. I got it. I had the trophy. I had the reward. I got to Golok Vrindavan or whatever. I became a pure devotee. Well, eternal becoming, it's perpetually humbling because you can never fully arrive. It's always further arrival. So it forces absolute humility. It's student forever, as Śrīla Siddhārtha Mahārāja will say. The more prem you have, the less prem you think you have. The more you become a Vaishnava, the less you think you are a Vaishnava. Again, not in any traumatizing way, but even a very natural way, in a very charming way. because you are confronted with a never-ending horizon of possibilities. So how much, as I like to say, how much we can colonize that? How much can I put my flag into an infinite horizon of possibilities and say, it's mine now. It's my country. I own it. I've caught it. It's like, so by nature, reality ignites humility. So humility shouldn't be seen as a very like of course it's a beautiful quality, but in one sense it's the natural response to contacting reality for what it is. So in one sense it's not something super extraordinary. I hope you get my point. I have nothing against humility. I'm just trying to not make humility something so super extraordinary that it feels unattainable. I mostly understand the super extraordinary thing is the nature of reality and its ever-evolvingness, and contacting that super extraordinariness creates humility as the only possible response to that. And that's why, as I mentioned also in the book, Sanatana Goswami says in Brihadbhagavatamrita, Dhaini and Prem are correlated, are cause and effect of one another. The closer you get to love, or the more love you have, however you want to put it, the more humble you become. That has to happen, because the more you contact love means the more you contact the ever-evolving nature of love, and therefore you become humble, because it's a never-ending horizon of possibilities. And you become more humble, and the more humble you become, the more space you are creating in your heart for a further manifestation of love, and that in itself creates an upgraded level of humility, and so on and so forth. The two act as cause and effect of one another. So humility is the natural response to a reality that is wonderful, ever evolving, not fully comprehensible, not fully understandable. There's always some unknowingness. At the same time, there is so much grace and gifts being given to us that we do not deserve. So from whatever direction you want to see it, it's the natural response to all of it should be humility. No, we don't need like to create like some excuses to be humble, like to really work hard to find reasons why should I be humble. But the moment we contact reality unfiltered, there's no other option but humility. You are humbled by what everything is. Even you're humbled by you contact who you are and the potential of the Atma. That's humbling. Not narcissistic, it's humbling. So the problem is the filters that do not allow humility to manifest, because the filters do not allow us to contact the wonderful becomingness of reality. So that's why we need to unfilter ourselves. That's anarthanibriti, basically. Sometimes we speak about reality unfiltered. We want that, a contact with reality unfiltered. So the filters are with us. We call them upadis, you call them anarthas, you name it as you want. So big part of the practice is to unlearn, to unfilter, to deconstruct false beliefs, false values, which are all the stuff that gets in the way from a genuine, raw, unfiltered contact with things as they are, which naturally they will evoke wonder, humility, all these desirable attributes. So, yeah, those are a few thoughts. Of course, again, there you have the whole chapter in the book to go more in detail about it, but I share a few words that hopefully are not me just doing copy paste of what's there in the pages, but there's all ongoing reflections of what it means to be a human becoming. And at the same time to live that in a healthy way, right? Because sometimes I mentioned that also in the book, the notion of becomingness can create like an obsession with the future. Oh, what I will become, what will be that? And I'm not there yet. And you can become frustrated and you can be like escaping the present. And so many toxic things can happen if I speak about becomingness, and so many toxic things can happen if I speak about being and not becoming. About anything we can talk, so many things can happen. We have that great talent to make everything toxic. As condition solves, right? So it's important to always be attentive to the potential, how do you say in English, shortcomings that can come with any idea. Any genuine beautiful idea has a potential shortcoming if we are not addressing it properly. So it's as beautiful and great as it is to speak about your potential and all that you can be, and this is an open future, perpetual disclosure, students forever, humility continually increasing, exciting news, surprise, astonishment, kijai. But we can turn all that around and just live an obsession with the future and be completely absent from the present, and do not learn to accept ourselves where we are here now, and do not understand that whatever potential we are invited to actualize, it all begins here and now or nowhere at all. So it's very important to also, again, have coherence in how we think and leave all the things, so we do not end up, how to say, lashing ourselves and feeling misery with a concept that in principle can bring so much joy and hope, right? So we even unconsciously we end up weaponizing against ourselves some of these noble ideas. So that's why it's very important to be attentive, you know, how these ideas are landing within myself, because I may be talking all this with some intention from some place, hopefully healthy, but if we may be filtering all that from another place, and that's landing inside of us in a toxic way, and then we feel terrible about ourselves or obsessed again with the future and bypassing the present and all these things that we never meant, but unconsciously and inadvertently we may have filtered them in that way. And again, this is not only applying to this topic we are talking today, it can be applied to anything. So that's why it's very important to have as much discernment and vigilance and introspection as possible. Vivek in Sanskrit, discernment in how the things are landing, how I'm processing the idea, how I'm digesting them, how I'm internalizing, what's the fruit of me taking this idea in, how I'm feeling. And also, hopefully, as much as we can discern, sometimes we may not discerning as ideally, so it's always healthy. Sadhusanga also is for that, in big part, not also, in big part is for that, to mirror some proper discernment that when we hear sadhu speaking, well-wishers speaking, oh, we realize, oh, I was not discerning in the way that I'm hearing, that I now realize I should be discerning. Or, oh, by hearing this discernment, I realize I was processing this idea, whatever it may be, in a partial way, in a toxic way. And now I'm getting a bigger picture that helps me to deal with this same idea in a healthy way. So I don't need to reject the idea. I don't need to throw the baby away with the bath water. I just need to replace my digestive process, so to say. And I think it's very important to how we navigate the whole practice. Because many times we may have received certain ideas explained in very toxic ways, unfortunately. Sometimes that can happen. Or sometimes the idea was not presented in a toxic way, but we process it in a toxic way for whatever reason. And we couldn't discern that. So, and that could have happened for years. And then we need to be exposed to, and eventually, my point is we may realize, oh, for years I was living my life with this belief or with this idea that was really a torment. It was a torture chamber. So now that I realize that, I will reject this idea altogether. But probably we will be throwing the baby away with the bath water. And sadly, we may be victimizing ourselves that the idea was given to me in that way. And again, sometimes that can happen. But again, at the end of the day, we also have our discerning faculty to, even if someone presents to me an idea very partial, very toxic, we still have to discern about it. We still have to use our God-given faculties to process them properly. What to speak if someone is presenting me the idea in a proper way. Also, it's my responsibility to allow that to land in my heart in a proper place, in a healthy place, in a nourishing place. And if that was not the case, I don't need to hate the world, to hate myself. It was what it was. I can still learn from that. But I have to be careful not to throw the baby away with the bathwater and reject the idea altogether, because it may be, again, a beautiful idea like the one we're discussing now. In my opinion, it's a very beautiful idea. But digested improperly, it can cause indigestion, so to say. So we need to be careful of separating and say, okay, I need to recalculate the way I'm processing this information, the way I'm understanding this idea, I'm internalizing it, I'm expressing it in practice in relationship. And that takes work. In one sense, it's easier to throw the baby away with the bathwater. And that's why we many times we do that, unfortunately. And that's just another side of the coin. Now, first I accepted the idea maybe blindly and in a toxic way, and then I rejected the idea blindly in a toxic way, just the other side of the coin. So the balance path will be keeping the valuable thing, discarding the toxic filterings of that, taking responsibility and digesting the idea properly. So it has its proper function. Like food, now certain food, if it's not properly prepared, you try to eat it and it's not giving your body the same amount of whatever vitamins, proteins that it will give if it's properly prepared. So it's the same way. We have the ingredients, but they have to be mixed properly together, cooked properly, if you will, digested properly. So there's a part of the process that is about us. So anyhow, I was not planning saying that, but it came at the end because I think it's, and we mentioned about, again, in my book, I mentioned the idea of becomingness can become dangerous if that becomes an evacuation plan from the present moment. I mentioned that. So now came some elaboration on that, which I hope that helps. Yeah, thank you, Rasangi. Thank you for the invitation. And before going to the next raised hand, I think it's a good moment to put a pause and invite those of you who would like to join our private rooms in Zoom, in groups of three or so we can, for a moment, discuss more in-depth churning in a more personal way what this all means to us, what has touched us more specifically, whether in the notion of being and becoming, the notion what just came in now, future as an escape to the present, or ideas being toxic and sometimes rejecting the whole thing altogether and throwing the baby away with the bath water. Whatever touched you the most, feel free to share. I'm opening the groups now. There they are. And see you back in a few minutes. Those who kind of join, invited for some moments of personal introspection. Well, welcome back. Hoping you had a good intimate sharing and further churning of some of these ideas, which again is part of the digesting process we were talking about. The very fact of sharing and hearing and mirroring back one another in reflection is how the whole thing gets internalized in the best possible way. So hopefully we are justifying whomever had the idea from Zoom to create something called breakout rooms, and we can honoring proper their ultimate purpose. Okay, we'll move to the next offerings. So in the list, let's go by order. We have Sham Kund from Czech Republic, but probably from Spain, speaking to us today. You let me know, Sham Kund. Welcome.
Hare Krishna, everyone. Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Yeah, I'm in Spain right now, northwest of Spain. And I would like to ask the question from Laverna, actually, which was stopped by the mystic experience of rock, paper, scissors.
Let's keep it a mystery for those who are not there. It's too confidential for people.
Yeah, confidential pastime. So I wanted to ask about the of four sampradayas that you mentioned, Maharaj, that the statement from Padma Purana was like added later. So I wanted to ask from where does it come from, and if I may add some more like general question to it. Like, how do you personally recognize the authorized traditions or schools? For example, I remember I was like reading some poems from Kabir some years back, and then I met one Brahmachari, one god brother in India, and he told me that it's not authorized. It's like that he had some Mayavadi inclinations or something like that. So I was like discouraged to continue to read his poems, but we were also reading it in La Verna, and I really find his poems beautiful. So maybe how do you perceive the like divine connection of the author or of the tradition in general?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have the tricky one question, but three questions in one or something like that. But it's okay. It deserves. It was waiting for a few days, so probably a few other questions appeared on the original one. So yeah, there is this one line that has been ascribed for a long time to the Padma Purana. I even learned it myself in the previous year, Sampradaya Vihina Ye Mantras, which basically means that if one doesn't receive mantra from one of the four Sampradayas, the verse is longer, but basically that's the main line. One does not receive mantra in one of the four Vaishnava Sampradayas, then the mantra is basically fruitless, no? Nishfala. There's no phala, no fruit. So that verse has been going on for a long time, but yeah, I would say in more recent years there has been a scholarship done around the text, comparing it with doing some critical editions of the Padma Purana and ancient manuscripts were actually, because that mantra appears in other texts and that's ascribed to the Padma Purana, but whenever you go to basically any edition of the Padma Purana, that line is not there. So the general consensus and conclusion among scholars and Vaishnavas as well, Vaishnava scholars and scholars who are not Vaishnavas themselves, is that the text was a later interpolation, like an addition which was not in the original. And now you're asking me who added that? I have no clue. Generally, we don't have any idea when it comes to interpolation in texts. Who did that, how that happened, which was the recent intention. We can just speculate and entertain some possibilities, as many people do. And there is a merit in that as well. Okay, why someone will have made such a statement and tried to make it canonical? Well, probably because there were some established Vaishnava Sampradayas, and in time, new Vaishnava Sampradayas were coming. And some of the older ones felt, I'm just again openly publicly speculating here, which is a legal exercise. There's a way of speculating which is healthy. I'm not just here speculating every possible way you want, but there are ways to contemplate possibilities. But yeah, some members from those four old Sampradayas may have felt a little threatened by their raising of new some Vaishnava Sampradayas, and they may wanted to create a more sectarian take on it. And these are only the four ones. So unless and until you are part of one of the of our clubs, so to say, you're an outcast or something like that. And the whole thing, it's of course a long conversation because of course when we say four Vaishnava Sampradayas, we will say Madhva Sampradaya, Sri Sampradaya, Rudra Sampradaya and Kumar Sampradaya, which have their own main acharyas, Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Nimbarkacharya, Vishnu Swami, Vallabhacharya, more contemporary, anyhow. And then comes the whole conversation with the Gaudiya Sampradaya. I won't go there too much into detail because that's a long conversation, because there are differences of opinions in terms of, okay, are we Are we aligned with the Madhva Sampradaya or not? Some will say Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. But the moment you start to study the Siddhanta of the Madhva Sampradaya, there are many things we don't have in common at all. And in many ways we have more things in common with the Ramanuja Sampradaya or Vallabha Sampradaya. Madhva Sampradaya, I won't enter into the details now because it's not the question, and I don't want to deviate from the question. But for many, the Gaudiya Sampradaya is the fifth Sampradaya. That's my point. Even if you go to Vrindavan, I don't know, to temples like Sri Radha Shamasundar, they have a big sign there like, we are not part of the Madhva Sampradaya. We are the Gaudiya Sampradaya. They put a big sign in the temple there. Some other Vaishnava, Gaudiya Vaishnava, will think differently, or they will nuance the conversation saying there was some nominal connection with the Madhva Sampradaya. But if you analyze the tenets and the principle, the Gaudiya Sampradaya is its own Sampradaya. And in that case, it will be considered outside of this group of four. So there is a fifth. And again, there is many other Vaishnava Sampradayas, Radha Vallabh, Swami Haridas, and many others, Vrindavan's Rasik Sampradayas, there are many of them. And of course, on top of that, there will be always, and in every tradition this happens, the accusation of that's not bona fide, this is the real Sampradaya, that's not the real Sampradaya, the same thing. I don't know, you go to Christianity, some will say Catholic Christianity, Roman Catholic is the real thing, the Adi thing, the original one, and whatever comes from that. Okay, if it's a branch from the Catholic Church, it's somehow bona fide still. But if you go to Protestantism and what to speak of Mormons or this or that, they will say that has nothing to do. And they will always be throwing things at one another. So there is not a universal consensus about what means a bona fide line, and you can just apply that and that's it. So that's one thing. So there is some degree of uncertainty. Of course, on the other side, something that has been historically there is, for example, in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, okay, you have you want to start a Sampradaya. You want to start. It's not so much like you wake up one day, okay, I want to start a Sampradaya. It sounds like a good business. Though some people are doing that, to be honest. Anyhow, that's another conversation also. But it happens, there happens to be a flow that it takes the shape of a particular Sampradaya that is, it has a uniqueness of its own. So historically, the people from that particular new emerging school is invited to present a commentary on what's called traditionally the Prashtana Trayi, Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, and especially Vedanta. So we will find that in all these known Vaishnava Sampradayas, there are tikkas, commentaries written on this to show the particular Siddhanta of that school. Because Sampradaya is basically Sampradaya. Pradaya means to give, and Sam means fully. So Sampradaya is a lineage that fully gives a particular conception, a particular Siddhanta. And it has to be different enough from the other Sampradayas to call itself another Sampradaya. Because if it's just a minor detail, it's just the same Sampradaya with some nuance, because every Sampradaya already has its own nuances. So for it to call it another Sampradaya, it has to be different enough. So in the Gaudiya tradition, Baladev Vidyabhushan wrote the commentary, the Govinda Bhashya on Vedanta Sutra at the time where, and at that time also, there are many socio-political reasons. When he was in Jaipur trying to make a case for the validity of Gaudiya Sampradaya, somehow the king of Jaipur at that time, there was this idea of this four Vaishnava Sampradaya. So for it to be taken somehow seriously, you had to have some type of affiliation with these four in some way. And many will understand that that's why he also emphasized the Madhva connection at that time. Though many also believe he was a Madhva and then converted, there are different theories and many scholars have investigated that. But I will say, yeah, what makes a tradition valid is one way you present your Siddhanta clearly in terms of the already existing canon. No? For example, okay, a Vaishnava tradition is coming. Okay, present your point of view, your conception, your perspective in a way that makes sense and based upon the ancient Shastra upon which all the other Vaishnava traditions have base themselves, whether it is Vedanta Sutra, Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. In our tradition, Jiva Goswami made the case for Bhagavatam being the Amala Pramana, the main epistemological source. So that's one way. Of course, then also you want to see the fruit of that Siddhanta in the form of embodied saints, right? Because if you come with a fancy new Sampradaya, with a fancy new Siddhanta, and everything is nice from a theoretical, philosophical point of view, but if in practice in time you are not seeing like the fruit of that coming embodied in the form of real people, real saints with how to say, moving life stories that are undeniable, that touch the hearts of so many others, as we find in all sampradayas, then it's a little strange, right? And that may take time for that to happen to some degree, but also generally the point will be the founders of these sampradayas, in order for you to found a sampradaya, you have to be a powerfully enough person that will be in itself a testimony to what the sampradaya is about in a living testimony. And it all may begin from there. If we want to talk in our tradition about Mahaprabhu, or in the Vallabha Sampradaya, they will talk about Vallabhacharya, and they call him Mahaprabhu in their line. And the whole tradition comes from these great personalities. So that's some thoughts regarding the first part of your question, or the first question. And then was something else in connection to someone mentioning that, or cautioning you about, I don't know, reading or sharing something from someone like Tukaram or whomever, in the sense that they are not a bona fide lineage or people. They may have some tinge of Mayavad. So let's be clear with this. First of all, many times in devotional circles, the word Mayavad is used in a derogatory way. And the point is that sometimes someone who embraces a doctrine of Advaita Vedanta is called Mayavadi. I get the point. There's a point to make in that regard, because for them there's a lot of Maya, there's a lot of everything. Everything's Brahman, but most of us see Maya, whatever, most of the things we see and we think they are real, they're all Maya, they basically may say. So in that sense, you can call them Mayavad, the path where basically it's a denial of Maya, neti neti. This is not Brahman, this is not Brahman, Maya, Maya. Okay, you can call it Mayavadi in some way, but the term is loaded and it's charged with a point, like implying if you embrace that line of thought, which is not ours, it's not our Sampradaya, but Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedanta is a Sampradaya, not a Vaishnava Sampradaya, but is a Sampradaya, which takes a particular, which has a particular take on scripture. And of course, there are different interpretations of that and different readings of that, but let's briefly say the following. And we also already mentioned that a few times, that the attainment of the impersonal dimension of the absolute is something plausible. I mean, it's an aspect of the absolute. Advaigyan tattva brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdete. So it's a genuine goal, which is not in our particular interest, but it's a genuine goal nonetheless, to be pursued by those who have the samskaras for that qualityless feature of the divines, if you want to put it that way. So my point with this is, if someone is connected to a lineage that is going after that, if we want to make the case that Tukaram was in that line, to be honest, I don't know. It doesn't seem to me, but let's put it that may be the case. Of course, it's not our line of thought, but that doesn't mean that they are not bona fide in their own particular line. Follow my point? Because some line is not going to my cup of tea, that doesn't make them non bona fide. I mean, if not, I have to say, okay, the Sri Vaishnavas who are after Lakshmi Narayan in Vaikuntha, they are not bona fide, because they don't want Radha Krishna in Golok Vrindavan. It's like that's nonsense. That's offensive. So in one way to say, those who want to merge into impersonal Brahman, that's not bona fide. That's a form of offense, because you are offending a dimension of the absolute called Brahman, which is eternal, which can host people in eternity there. Again, not our cup of tea, but it's there. So that's a genuine goal in it, sustainable in eternity. Therefore, those who are pursuing that, they are pursuing the dimension of the absolute in eternity. So in itself, that's glorious. There is a glory to that, even if it's not my cup of tea. So that's a big invitation for non-sectarianism, because it's very easy to despise those who are not just running after what I think is the best thing and say, no, don't go there. So that's one thing. Of course, at the same time, I understand that in certain stages, people may get confused if they study in detail or think everything is the same, and then start to receive like a mixed conception between personalism and impersonalism. And in the beginning, one may need to be more rooted and grounded in one's own ideal and tradition. I totally understand that, and we mentioned that repeatedly. But also, there is place for us to derive nourishment and inspiration from people from different lineages whose goal is not ours. I mean, we have been just in La Verna, like connecting with St. Francis and Christianity. Their goal is not the same as ours, let's be honest. I mean, they don't want to be a manjari of Sri Radha in Golok Vrindavan. Let's be honest. That doesn't mean we cannot go there. That doesn't mean we cannot learn from that. We cannot be nourished. At the same time, we should be, yeah, you should have a clear understanding which are the differences, so we don't just make everything the same thing, because that's a khichdi. So, but there is a place to be nourished by diversity, as I repeatedly say. That's our tradition. No? Gaudiya Vaishnavism, if we want to see, going back to the first part of your question, if we want to see Gaudiya Vaishnavism as its own sampradaya, the fifth sampradaya founded by Mahaprabhu, further given shape by the Goswamis, or founded by the Goswamis in one sense, because Mahaprabhu didn't found anything officially, though he started to give shape by instructing the Goswamis, and the movement started, as I'd like to say, with his movement, inner and outer. But the Gaudiya Sampradaya and the orthodoxy of Gaudiya Sampradaya coming, not, I don't know, from the six Goswamis and their texts like Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu, like Shat-Sandarbha, and so on and so forth. There is so much sacred borrowing in those texts from other traditions and other texts. As I like to say, Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu's whole structure of rasa, of Bhakti's rasa, is borrowed from Bharat Muni's Natya-shastra, which is a book on secular aesthetics. It's not even a book on spirituality. And Rupa Goswami is unapologetically borrowing from that and adding, of course, his own genius and unique contribution. But still, there is some taking from getting nourished and inspired from some other place, which is not even a spiritual book. It's a secular treatise on aesthetics. And that helped to build the structure from one of the main books of the Gaudiya Vaishnava orthodoxy. Nityananda Prabhu is mentioning even Hamsadutta is a borrowed idea. You name it, no? Maybe from Meghaduta of Kalidas, again, one of these famous poets in India. So we have many of that. Srila Shiva Goswami, I'd like to say, in the Shat-Sandarbha, he's building the whole Shat-Sandarbha is like the Summa Theologica of Thomas Aquinas in Christianity in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, like this big theological tome to explain our tradition in our own terms. But he's quoting Jamatri Muni, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya in support of his Gaudiya points. So to say, he's even quoting Shankaracharya, and not to refute him. At times he's refuting Shankaracharya, but at times he's quoting Shankaracharya, drawing support from a Mayavadi, if you want to call it that way. Of course, we see Shankaracharya way in a broader way. Mahadev coming with certain purpose, that's another conversation. But my point is, again, all these Gaudiya Orthodox works from the Goswamis, you cannot get more orthodox than going to the Goswami. There is lots of nourishment from lineages who are, some of them theistic, monotheistic, devotional, some of them secular, some of them monistic, and there's a place. So again, we have to have the realization and capacity to cross-pollinate in a way that is bona fide. Because if not, we can also mix in ways that are not tasteful, and rasabhas, so of many ways, can be there. So not everyone and anyone can do that. But we see that being done from our founding acharyas, and as part of the parampara, we are invited to imbibe that spirit and learn to do that eventually when it's the time ourselves to properly represent our sampradaya, being properly rooted and familiar with it, but at the same time open to enough cross-pollination to allow the whole lineage to continue growing, like this analogy that I shared the other day to conclude my sharing here. That Bhakti Rasa gave, when we were talking at in Rome, we were with Bhakti Rasa and Bhakti Lalita Devi, disciple of Srila Bhakti Sundar Govinda Maharaj. And we were talking about narrow-mindedness and those who, in the name of chastity to a lineage, of chastity to a tradition, do not open themselves to anything and become extremely insular and sectarian and narrow-minded and rigid, that it can happen, and it has happened, and it happens. So she gave the interesting example, and I made a short post about it. She gave the I gave the example of she gave the example, and I developed a little bit of certain royal lineages from Europe, especially King in Spain, that they were obsessed to preserve the chastity of the bloodline, the royal bloodline. So they had he had all the family members marrying with each other, so they wouldn't interact with anyone outside of the blue blood, the imperial blood of the lineage. So after very quickly, there start to be dysfunctionals in the family, mental illnesses, and the end result was the whole dynasty was destroyed. But the original intention was to preserve the purity of the lineage, to remain chaste. So that analogy served to apply to what we are talking now here. If we become utterly insular and we just want to have ourselves as the only point of reference and stop cross-pollinating, which is another way to speak about that, the bees taking pollen and things from one flower to another and taking from diversity, exposing ourselves to enough diversity as to survive and be nourished. It's a survival thing, this. If that doesn't, it's not there, and it's just sheer insularity, it's the beginning of the end, basically. Even though we are claiming that we are preserving the line in the most chaste ways, you're actually killing the whole thing. It becomes more and more suffocating. There is no longer space to breathe properly. So we need to grow and learn how to cross-pollinate in the service of the tradition. That takes time, that takes preparation, but everyone needs to do that, because if not, you end up with a cult or with the end of a particular tradition, or the drying up of a particular branch of the tree of a particular tradition. So those are some thoughts from Akund. I don't know if I address somehow some of your concerns. You let me know.
Yes, thank you very much. I really love the word or the comparison of cross-pollination. I didn't know the word before. I got to know it from you, and we don't have it in our language, in Czech language, and it's really
You can create it, no problem.
it's
You're
really
in Spain now, so you can say cross-pollinización. There you have it.
bien.
Yeah, so it's in nature, right? It's not just about spiritual lineages. It's all over in this in the na in nature, in the system of things, in the order of things. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we can go one more time, why not, to the breakout rooms and share it together a little bit. Whatever. We discuss a few different topics about lineages and four sampradayas, and that's probably been a fifth one, and interpolation in scripture, and we being Madhvas or not, and interacting, cross-pollinating with other traditions, and Advaita Vedanta, is that bona fide or not? What's a sampradaya, and so on. So you pick whatever sounded relevant for you that you feel inspired enough to share in the rooms. I will put pause to the recording, and I will invite you to go in. Welcome back to one of you. Hoping you had a fruitful sharing of hearts and minds, and brainstorming and heartstorming as well. I will continue. We have two more raised hands. First came Chandrika from Hawaii, and then we have Gayatri. So we invite Chandrika to begin with to mute herself and bring whatever you would like to offer today to the table. Welcome.
Oh, sorry, Paul Maharaj. I want to express gratitude for Laverna before the question, and how instrumental you were in creating such an incredibly loving community. I had never met anyone, and by the end there was such a hug fest. Our driver couldn't leave the expression on his face.
Hugfest. I like that one. We can organize whole events with that name, Hugfest. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Thank you to you as well. You were all instrumental in that as well. Yeah.
I'm part of a reading group, and actually everyone in our reading group is here except one person. We started reading Bhanu Maharaj's Govinda Lilamrita, and starts with, a very detailed description of all these different birds and all the different ways they're trying to wake up the divine couple and persuade them to go home so they don't get in trouble. And then I was reflecting on Saint Francis and the relationship that he had with birds. And there's also a lot of birds where I live, so I'm just curious to hear your reflection and how it applies to our lives, because you're very good at applying to our lives.
So you would like to hear my reflection on what specifically, just to be fully clear, on birds, which I'm fine. I'm okay talking about birds, but specifically in connection to something that you
In
have just
connection
shared.
to Radha Krishna's pastimes, Saint Francis' pastimes, and how that might relate to our life and could be our relationship with birds. However you like, Maharaj.
Thank you. Okay, let's fly as high as we can, trying to say something about it. Fly with our own wings. Let's start using bird analogy here. Birds ki jai. Yeah, well, we just Nityananda mentioned this idea of Rupa Goswami's book, the Hamsa Dut, no? Which means Hamsa is a swan and Dut means a messenger. So in itself, that book it speaks about a bird. This one is a type of bird acting as a messenger, no? With a message from Radha to Krishna in this case. So that's very much the role, I will say, of birds. Not to limit that to them to that, but in big part in the Leela, as the reading of Govinda Lilamrita unfolds, you will see how the birds are very expert messengers. Again, they have the advantage of flying and very, very quick and bringing messages, whatever, whenever that's required. So nature is very instrumental in the dynamics of the eternal Leela. Of course, Govinda Lilamrita is basically a detailed exploration of one day in the life of God. Let's put it that way. Let's be careful not to think that every day is like that. I mean, there's a lot of that, but more. It's just one day in the life of God. Let's write a book about it. No, Govinda Lilamrita. Then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur wrote Krishna Bhavanamrita. Say, let's write another day in the life of God. And it's another exploration of Ashtakaliya Lila from slightly different angle. No? And again, we shouldn't find a conflict. Oh, they are saying different things, of course, because every day is not the same. But birds are all over, nature is all over. Of course, Vrindavan is a very nature-based place if we want to concentrate on the Braja Lila. The trees are so present, the flowers, the vines, if we pay attention, the birds, the different animals, even in the Rasa Lila, when Krishna disappeared from the Rasa dance, there is so much detailed depiction about the gopis speaking with all the members of the forest, basically, right? Addressing each one of them and detailed depiction of the different flowers and the vines and this plant, this other plant, and the trees and the river. So everything at the end becomes Udipana. No, Udipana is this word. That Rupa Goswami invokes as one of the ingredients for Bhakti Rasa, which is like we could say more contemporarily a trigger, something that triggers us in something in us, like stimulant. That we see that and so birds also do that. The presence of nature is a constant, it's in constant arrangement and movement to provide the best possible landscape. Birds, as you mentioned, are there from the very beginning, are very crucial and instrumental from the beginning of the new day of Radha and Krishna. As agony, as agonic, agonic, you have that word in English, like something that has the quality of
Oh,
agony.
iconic.
Okay, because that's a paradox thing, right? For us as sadhakas, we will say, okay, it's speaking about nature, it's raining really hard here in Switzerland. So I'm very happy that I didn't choose to do my class outside. Because when we started, it was really sunny, and now it's raining these snowballs. So all glories to nature, but I'm glad I'm inside now. So I lost track of that. Sorry, what I was saying with birds. Oh, at the beginning of the day, something very paradoxical in the beginning of the day is that it's called Brahma Muhurta, right? So for us, as sadhakas, Brahma Muhurta is depicted as the most auspicious time of the day for all the reasons we've heard. But in the Leela, Brahma Muhurta is the most inauspicious time of the day for Radha and Krishna, because that's the time when they have to separate from one another. So that's a very interesting dynamic, right? Because that's the moment that the day begins. But for them, the day is the night when they meet in Rasa Leela. Now that's where. How to read this verse from the Bhagavad Gita. What is day for one person is night for the other. Right? So even for the rest of Vrindavan, day is day and night is night. But for the gopis and Radha, day is night and night is day. So in that most complex moment, you know, beginning your day with agony, the agony of separating from one another, the birds play this crucial role of on one side, waking Radha and Krishna up because the sunlight is coming and the whole village of Vrindavan cannot become aware of their illicit, quote unquote, Parakiya affair. So birds are like the clock alarm. There are no cell phones in Braj, just in case, guys. So you start to get detached from your clock alarm in your cell phone and eventually get accustomed to being the birds waking you up. Not like when you are in a natural environment, that's the case. Birds starts to sing at the beginning of the day, and you wake up naturally with following that rhythm. So that's in Vrindavan. They start to wake Radha and Krishna up gradually, reminding them the day is starting, Jatila, Kutila are waking up, the whole village is waking up. We don't want you to be caught. It's time to go back to your respective homes and fake that you were sleeping the whole night long there, that you didn't have much sleep at all. So that's a very difficult moment for Radha and Krishna to wake up and realize we have to be separate from one another, as we heard many times. Subjectively speaking, 1 nanosecond of that separation feels like a yuga, right? Yuga itam nimeshena chakshusa pavrisaitam, Mahaprabhu says in the 7th verse of Shikshastakam. Sunjaitam jagat sarvam govinda virahena me. He's embodying Radha Bhav, how Radha feels for Govinda, but also arguably how Govinda feels for Radha. One moment, one nimisha. Nimisha is basically like the time it takes to blink. Yugaitam nimeshena. One nimisha feels like a yuga. Chakshusa pavrisaitam, and tears come pouring like it's pouring now here in Switzerland. That will be the crying in separation of the divine couple when they realize the night that is our day is over. Sunjaitam jagat sarvam. The whole universe looks void. In separation from my beloved. So birds are very sensitive in the Leela. Again, they know they have to wake them up. They need to, because again, the Leela has to continue. The Parakya Leela has to continue with all the risk and intensity and commitment and that it implies. So they have to wake them up, but they have to wake them up in a way that is not that traumatizing, so to say, that painful. Still will be an ocean of pain, but in a soft way, and the birds will be singing different times, different ways. One time it does not sufficient. They will wake up, they will fall asleep again, they will get together again, one more union before leaving, one more before leaving again, and so on. So they have to do this surgical work to separate Radha and Krishna in a way that is sensitive enough that they do not die from each other's separation right at the beginning of the day. So that's kind of how the day starts for the birds. So for us to have an idea of how important their service is. And during the rest of the day, they play so many of these roles as well. Of course, Radha has different birds, and she trains them to sing in particular ways, different songs in ways that only she understands. Or Krishna teaches some pets. He knows some particular birds that are not. The arrangement of Yoga Maya is that these certain particular birds do not have very good memory to learn a very long line of poetry for them to recite. So Krishna knows who they are, that he calls them, and he teaches them very long poetry to like fake what's actually going on. And the whole poetry starts with the word dhara, which means current. But it continues with a lot. So, but the bird is bewildered by the length of the line. So Krishna says, it's okay, just stay with the first word. It's fine. So everyone sees that publicly. Okay, Krishna's being understanding with the bird. So the bird just repeats dhara. And the more you say dhara, you end up saying radha. No? So another very valuable service. No, dhara and dhara means current also, no? There are many, many ways to dhara and radha, but it's not the moment to go there now. Badra is mentioning in the comments that Brinda Devi, who is a big facilitator, big orchestrator of the whole movement in the Lila, especially she's like a sylvan goddess, so she's a forest goddess, so she's very much in tune with all the elements of nature that are required, the particular weather and seasons and particular flowers to bloom at the particular Lila, particular fruits to manifest from a certain tree at any given moment. So she's also communicating, Badra mentions, with the birds in the Seva of Radha and Krishna. So again, there is a whole network, let's put it that way, of interaction and relationality and ongoing dialogue to keep the Lila like ongoing, to keep the Lila successful. And not only birds, but birds are not to be underestimated. Actually, nothing is to be underestimated there, which is an important thing, right? Unfortunately for us here, a bird sometimes is just a bird. Even if you hear it singing in the this, oh yeah, you don't even notice it. Some people like to shoot at birds. It's part of some people's culture. It's the season to shoot birds. For some other people, it's putting birds into cages. Or again, there are different ways we relate to birds. Though I wouldn't call that much of a relationship. But I think going from the Lila and the role of the birds in the highest, deeply, most esoteric realm to here and now, and the example of Saint Francis or even Mahaprabhu or so many others, the importance of, yeah, learning to learn from the birds where we are now here. So we can enter the realm where birds will be our gurus. No? Srila Siddhartha Maharaj will say, you want to enter the land of gurus, where everything and everyone will be your guru. Huh? And you will be the servant of everyone. Of course, everyone will be thinking in the same way. Everyone will be thinking, everything is my guru and I'm the servant. So everyone has the abhiman or the identification of servant, but everyone is being guru for everyone else. So the birds will be our gurus. So we, speaking about birds, we want to enter a land where every bird will be our guru. So if we want to enter a place in eternity with every single bird will be a guru guiding us, helping us, facilitating seva, why not start here seeing birds as gurus? No? Why what does a bird have to teach me? No? And then we can start to draw lessons from the bird. No? Again, the bird is, I just mentioned a few of them. 1 second, I'm closing the window. It's raining really loud. So, in the 24 gurus of the Bhagavad, and a few birds are mentioned, not only one. I already gave an example of a swan, which is a bird. And the swan is said to take from a mixture of water and milk the essence, no? Which is milk. I had never heard that that has been scientifically proof. It can be just a mythological analogy, and that's totally fine. But we can still draw the idea. We have to become saragrahi, take the active principle of things and not get entangled into the details. Or a parrot, speaking about birds, Sukadev Goswami, parrot, again, mythologically speaking, I don't think has been proven anyway. It bites a fruit, it makes it sweeter. Also, a parrot can just parrot, copy, paste, and repeat something without giving much thought. So, which parrot do you want to be? No? And of course, birds are starting the day singing, no? And they sing for the sake of singing. They are not having an audience, no, that is like praising them and applauding them or paying them or giving food to them. They just sing for the sake of singing. They're starting their day celebrating existence. And they are absolutely detached of the result. They are not looking for a fruit of their singing. The fact that they can sing is the fruit in itself. So that's Bhaktiya Sanjataya Bhaktiya. We want to engage in singing, kirtan, kirtaniya sadahari, for the sake of serving, of kirtan. We are not doing this to obtain something separate. So the verse is a very nice embodiment of that. And again, so many birds. We can talk. Bhadra is quoting Garuda, of birds are Garuda. Our Goswami will give the Chataka bird. Now that it's raining tremendously here. Chataka bird is this beautiful mythical bird that only will drink water from the rain. In other words, the determination of the Chataka bird is I only one will come from above. And Srila Maharaj poetically will say, maybe a thunderbolt will come from above and will kill me. Or maybe nothing will come from above. But the determination of the Chataka bird is I only want what's descending, basically, descending grace. Even if I'm starving, I won't take anything from a place that is not connected to the descending plane, so to say. That's the determined life or death determination of the Chataka bird, right? Looking upward in the direction of descending grace. A similar example is with the Chakora bird. No? Chakora is a bird that is said that is nourished by the moonbeams. No? When everything is dark, the Chakora in the midst of of darkness, where everything is dark, is looking in the source of light in the midst of darkness. So the same way, when we feel we are going through a dark night of the soul, if you want to use that analogy, there's always a moon ray being there, a Chandrika, no? Chandrika is asking the question. No? Like Vishwanatha Chakravarti wrote his book, Raga Barma Chandrika. There are many books with the name Chandrika, which is a moon ray, right? With something, and moon is giving light, is giving nourishment, is giving taste and flavor to things, is the source of rasa. And the Chakora bird is like the symbol of looking for that nourishing light in the midst of darkness. Another ways in which birds appear in our tradition, and we have so many more, of course. And again, going to just the birds we see in the here and now, they're singing for their own sake. I remember at the conclusion of radical personalism, there is one section that is speaking about birds and speaking about singing, and I think it's called something like "Sing Your Own Song" or something like that. Let me check for a moment. One second. Yeah, never give up your song, basically. And I have a little section here because, okay. Yeah. It says, just as a bird beckons the morning, it's the conclusion of the book. This book has been a sincere attempt to sing a song. That's what we can try to do as best every day. My life, my day is an attempt to sing my song. Not, I cannot sing your song. I have to find my song and sing it. Hopefully, it is one that reaches a place where words like this cannot. We call that place home. Home is not the name of a tree in which our songbird nests. Home is the name of our song, for that is the place we truly live from and live through. Wherever we learn to sing our song, that is then to be known as home. Not because our nest is there, but because our song is. In other words, what matters most isn't staying faithful to the tree or the nest we have built in it, but rather staying faithful to the song. To the song, in this case, I mentioned in the book of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Some Gaudiyas will remain in their old familiar tree and sing their song from there. Others will stay in that tree but tragically give up singing entirely. And some others will leave the tree and continue to sing their song somewhere else. So the motto of radical personalism given by Sri Gaudahari himself is Kirtaniya Sadahari, never give up your song. So just came to my mind, go under. What is the source of this quote, Nityananda Prabhu is asking? It's from my book, Radical Personalism. It's at the end of the book, it's in pages three. It's a subsection, Learn to Sing Your Song, pages 375, 376. And in particularly, this section is also inspired by something that Brian McLaren wrote in his book, Do I Stay Christian? On which I derive inspiration from my book, Radical Personalism, as well. So anyhow, something else we can learn from this, from the birds, of course, and again, so many of the things, the bird, when they are born and they are pushed out of the, by the mother, gradually nested, but eventually pull out to learn to develop strength to fly with their own wings. Also learn to fly with your own wings. You cannot fly with someone else's wings. You have to sing your own song, fly your own flight, use your own wings. We can be literally, if we really focus on that, we can be eternally for eternity drawing so many teachings. That's part of the contemplative mindset we all want to develop, right? Like Mahaprabhu saw the blade of grass, so much in the blade of grass. Saw a tree, so much in the tree. Saw a bird, so much in a bird. Anything. So it's good that we try to develop this faculty of sitting with something and try to, again, find Guru Tattva there. Find Guru Tattva. And that will be the most genuine way of us being gradually transported realistically to that land of gurus where everything is guru, the birds, the tree, the blade of grass, everything. So that's what came now, Chandrika. I hope
Thank you, Maharaj. Nectar, thank
that's
you.
poetically enough to satisfy your poetic sensibilities also, because
Yeah.
it's a very poetic topic and subject. And yeah, of course, if any one of you feel inspired, you can write a whole book about birds and lessons from birds. I'm sure so many people have done that. So that confirms this particular fact. Okay. We have one more question from Gayatri. But I feel tempted to go to the breakout rooms before that, a few minutes. So let's go there because I think birds deserve a few minutes more of our churning. So let's go to the breakout room for a few minutes. I will pause the recording and then see you in a few minutes for the last sharing of today. Welcome. Welcome back to you all. And we'll conclude today's gathering with one more question or offering from Gayatri, from Italy. So,
Pranam.
welcome. Welcome.
Yes, well, the question maybe has a little bit of implications, but the fact is that I've heard from different groups and philosophies inside the Gaudiya Vaishnavism about the soul, the consciousness and the desire that guides them. So I want you to clarify for me how this works, if the soul is something different from the citta, or if the desire comes from the soul or not. Like, I'm very confused about this now.
Okay, well, I hope I understood correctly. You want me to talk about if the soul is different from the citta?
Yes, and from the body, or if it's a whole, like the personality we are, if we have to consider it as our identity in general, or if there is some division, some structure.
Thank you. Thank you for the question and. Sorry if I won't be able to answer it in all the detail that I would like, because maybe being the last question, I may not have all the time in the world, but I'll try to honor it. I remember we developed spent some section of that in this chapter on individuation also in the book in Radical Personalism. And yeah, there are different of opinions in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, as we say before, not only between Sampradayas, but in one Sampradaya there are differences of opinion, not sometimes necessarily that the opinion one is black and the other is white, but that there is some more nuance than in one direction or in the other, in different views. And again, there is place for that. There will be place for that even in eternity. Different nuances, different perspectives, as long as it's not entirely different, there is place for that. There should be place for that to coexist with some degree of nuance, difference that is all valid, so to say. Of course, some things may not be valid when they already deviate from something. But in this connection, sometimes one could make like the very, let's say, hard division. Okay, we are not this body, we are a spiritual soul. So you are not your body, you are not your mind, your citta, your buddhi, ahankar, your emotions, your psychology, your all that, you are not, you are a spiritual soul. So all that stuff, you are not. So you don't need to pay much attention to that. I'm giving just a little bit of an extreme toxic example of what I consider toxic example of creating a divide in a way that is not sustainable. Because even if I say, okay, I won't be living this particular physical body for eternity, that's clear because, I mean, everyone is leaving their body all around, as we say before. That doesn't mean that I should like neglect it, so to say, or shouldn't treat it as sacred, or even treat it as yeah, something that is facilitating seva. At the same time, a more nuanced perspective will be, in this particular body you are now, with your particular physical features and your particular subtle features in your personality, your psychology, which in one sense is a byproduct of previous lives and choices and so on, right? It's not that if we accept the notion of reincarnation, it's not that we are born over and over again with the same face, with the same psychology, in the same place. It's not exactly that. So we accept, okay, this in one sense is a byproduct, the body, psychic material, a result of previous choices in the context of Maya Shakti, let's put it that way, not in any negative way, just to state the facts and be take responsibility for that. But if, let's say, hypothetically, right, in this lifetime one begins practicing bhakti, we never know if this is the first lifetime or not, but just hypothetically, and you start to conceive your body no longer as a material body, now you start to think in terms of this is a sadaka deha. This is a practitioner's body. Now, to say that in the moment of initiation, guru gives mantra, gives nam, gives different things, and among other things, gives a name and gives a whole new sense of identity, a new abhiman, a new way of seeing yourself, no longer as I'm this person born in this country. I mean, not to deny those things on some relative level, but in the deepest way, you are provided with a new way of seeing, looking at yourself. So that also marks the beginning of the spiritualization of your whole sense of identity, of pouring bhakti samskaras, devotional impressions in your psyche, in your emotions, in your body, engaged in seva. Everything is bhaktified, let's say that way, right? Poured with bhakti samskaras to replace the other samskaras we may have acquired outside of the realm of bhakti. So there is a point in which, again, you first we have baddha jiva, conditioned soul, then we have sadaka, which means still there is some conditioning, but you are in the process of awakening, let's put it that way. So it's no longer a baddha jiva, but you are not yet a siddha, right? The perfected being. So work in progress. When that sadaka, when this life of a practitioner becomes embedded in bhakti, physically, psychically, all the dimensions like imbued with that, we could make a case. I mean, and we make it. Generally, we speak about the bodies, the physical bodies of pure devotees as not physical bodies. We will say those are spiritual bodies, fully spiritualized, venerable, worshipable. Of course, in a deeper way, every atom is worshipable because Krishna is residing there. But when we speak about certain people who have really immersed themselves in bhakti in every pore of their being, that's a more overt expression of that for most of us. And we especially may venerate that. So that's saying, like, okay, there's a way then for the material body to, if the material body is fully spiritualized in bhakti, fully bhaktified, some of our acharyas will say, Vishwanacha comments that in one purport to the Bhavat, and that's what I quoted in radical personalism. At that point, your whole being became saturated with bhakti. So your eternal identity in the lila will be kind of a replica of who you were here as a perfected being. So your body, your physical appearance will resemble, and I'm not saying it's exactly the same, but will resemble, because that's why sometimes in some tradition they put the body of a pure devotee in what they call samadhi, not burning it, preserving it with salt, like trying to give this idea in some realm that body, that identity eternally exists in service. No? In a young age, younger age, but still the point is made. No? Like when Mahaprabhu put the body of Haridas Thakur in samadhi with his own hands, he established that precedent. No? He took the body of Haridas Thakur, he danced with the body, he bathed the body, he touched the body and say, I'm purified by that. So many things Mahaprabhu taught about sadhak, about the perfected body of a practitioner, a siddha. So we could make the case that the physical body, fully bhaktified, attaining some eternal status in the form of some replica of that identity, to serve in the lila, and the same with the psychic state. No? Of course, there may be some features of our personality, if now maybe quite dysfunctional, that won't enter into the lila. So we need to work on that before, or those will be purified before, as we were talking the other day. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says, even if you were very devotionally advanced, spiritually awakened, vertically developed, but horizontally on a more human, psychological, emotional level, you're a little bit still dysfunctional with a few unhealed parts. But you're very advanced spiritually. That can happen, that dichotomy can happen. There is this place where Raghavarma Chandika, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, say you attain Gokul, Vrindavan on earth, whatever Krishna is performing his deed on earth, and you are born from the womb of an eternal of a gopi surrounded by eternal associates. So if you were very advanced, but still with some, how to say, unhealed human parts that will get in the way of the lila, you are born right from the womb and surrounded by eternal associates who are fully human, fully divine. And by those samskaras, whatever remain unhealed will be in place. So there's a place to say you will have in your Siddha Deha or in your spiritual identity. Here we speak about a physical body and we speak about the subtle body, right? Ma composed of manas, buddhi, ahankara, citta. Citta refers more like to the subconscious mind. So it is also made the case that in a Siddha Deha or a fully spiritual body, you will have a body, the form, but it's a spiritual body, spiritual form. It's not physical, but it looks physical. We see the paintings, they look physical, or we'll hear it. They're made of consciousness. Ghana Chetana is the expression in Sanskrit, which means like condensed consciousness, thickened consciousness. And there will be a corresponding manas, buddhi, Ahankara and cittas fully spiritualized in the lila. No, again, there's nothing wrong with having a mind, intelligence, a sense of being. All that has its place in lila. In fact, there are four Priyanarma Sakas or intimate friends of Krishna who are said that represent Krishna's buddhi, Krishna's manas, Krishna's ahankar. Krishna has ahankar. Again, it's not a negative false ego thing. It's now a sense of identity in the lila, eternal sense of identity. So that will be, in my opinion, a more nuanced and user-friendly way of conceive things, not only in eternity, but of start to relate here and now with our own physical body or sadhaka deha, I will say, and psychic body. Not so much of things that I need to get away from and I need to reject and get rid of this stuff so I finally attain who I am, but I need to pour bhakti on them. It's not, again, as we talked in the Laverna retreat, it's not about rejecting anything in bhakti, it's just about adding bhakti to the equation. And everything finds its proper place and proper purpose. So we don't need to reject body, physical, psychic, emotional, anything. just bring body bhakti into the equation, and everything becomes so bhakti is so user friendly to everything that everything attains its place of perfection in eternity with bhakti included there. So in that way, we could attain a sense of identity that is not, of course, not exactly the same as the one we have now, because we are still, at least I speak for me, not fully enlightened at all. But at the same time, it's not absolutely different that it may create some type of dichotomy, like, okay, I'm now this person, but who I will be in eternity has absolutely nothing to do with who I think I am in any sense of the term. That may be a little bit like create like a disjointing thing. So we don't need to fully, and that may take our own practice in a way of self-denial. Okay, I have to reject this body, I have to deny my way of thinking, my way of being. The personality that I have acquired is a byproduct of the guna, so I have to try to be the exact opposite way. Who knows, no? And so many forced dysfunctionalities come rather than taking a more user-friendly approach, which is, yes, some things may need to be get rid of. They are really clearly toxic, may need to be healed, but many other things just need to be remain there and just add bhakti to them. And there's a place for that in eternity. So that's our teaching actually, and that one is more way nuanced, why and body friend, bodily friend oriented, everything friendly oriented. So we don't end up practicing bhakti as denialists or rejectionists or reductionists, but acceptionists, accepting everything from the best possible place. So I don't know if that helps. I don't know if that helps, Gayatri.
Yes, a lot, but I have to sharpen a little bit the question the next time I
Yes, I
will.
depend on, I depend. I can just answer based on how much you have sharpened the pencil when writing the question. If there was something more specific, then I need to be made conscious of what's the question behind the question. So we can leave that for the next one because we are almost in time now. But I'd like to invite you a few more minutes before we conclude to one last. Breakthrough rooms, hopefully, so we can share some thoughts about, we can turn together about this idea of how to relate to physical, psychic body in different ways, how much that can be related to the Atman in itself, and so on and so forth. So I will stop the recording and I will send you to those rooms. Okay, welcome back. Hope you had a joyful meeting, meaningful. And with this, we will put to pause today's meeting for today, expressing gratitude to each one of you for your gathering today, your questions, your presence, your attention, your empathy, your openness to share, to listen, to receive one another, and create spaciousness and create community all together by us showing up every weekend like we try to do, some of us at least. So it's part showing up not only weekly but showing up for life and whatever we need to show up. So thanks so much for your presence and your gifts, and we'll be seeing each other next weekend. I will be still be here. Yeah, so looking forward to that. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol. वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः.